The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler.
The BioRevolution Podcast, welcome to the show again. Easy as always. Of course, we start with quotes, but only after I've told everybody the title of today's story, AI-driven protein design beyond nature's blueprint. This is what we have at stake. But let's start with the quotes.
Yes, let's start with the quotes. And I would start with one quote from Heiner Linke. He's a chair of the Nobel Committee for Chemistry. And he said about awarding the Nobel Prize in Chemistry to John Jumper and Demis Hassabis and David Baker. One of the discoveries being recognized this year concerns the construction of spectacular proteins. The other is about fulfilling a 50-year-old dream, predicting protein structures from the amino acid sequences. Both of these discoveries open up vast possibilities. And despite the fact that we're, I think, not going to talk about structure that much, I think the hype surrounding AI-based protein design comes a little bit from the successes of being able to predict structure based on sequence as recognized by the Nobel Prize Committee and by quite a large amount of funding for biotechs in the space. And we have a biotech founder and CEO of Provolut today with us, Ingmar Schuster, who also brought us a quote about maybe the AI hype in protein design and biotech per se.
So, yeah, currently, I think what most people perceive AI for biology and biotechnology as is it's like a windshield wiper when it's raining heavily. So biology is super complex. AI helps a bit, but then the next problem comes around. And I think everybody understands what the potential is, but it is not as fast to realize the potential as compared to areas where there's vast amounts of data like text and images and video.
And this, I think, is a nice starter to dive into this episode. Ingmar, just to introduce you very briefly, you are, as I said, founder and CEO of Provolut, a biotech concerned with AI-driven protein design, and we'll dive into what you guys are doing in a bit. And I think you have, I really like the word on your homepage, that you're multi-passionate, that you don't only care about AI, but also in computer science, linguistics, psychology. And I think psychology is a good point, because I think we'll also dive into that. How do you actually get people together and get them to speak the same language when you try to conduct these kinds of projects? And your background is in computer science, as I take it. So you have also worked outside the biotech space, right? So you are by nature not in the biomedicine field, but you have transitioned there. So maybe we can actually start with that. How does that feel? Is the data better on the other side of the fence, or how do you like the biomedical data?
So I studied two things. I studied computer science and linguistics, actually. Mm-hmm. I did a diploma and a magister back at the time. And my PhD was on modeling the meaning of natural language. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't very good in the, like, I didn't have revolutionary results in my PhD, but they came later, obviously. And I used machine learning for this. It's a thing that many natural language processing people say. Proteins are basically like human natural language. There is some truth to that. Proteins are represented by a few letters that are ordered in sequence. So it's a simple data structure. If you have this data science machine learning viewpoint, the big problem, I think, for many researchers is there's not a lot of data. And the data, acquiring one data point is extremely costly as compared to natural language.
Why are we so excited about new proteins? Why do we need more proteins? Nature has gifted us a lot of proteins. I asked ChatGPT yesterday how many proteins there are, and I did not get a satisfactory answer across species. But I mean, we have a lot of proteins, right? We have our proteome. We have all the proteomes of all plants and animals and microbes and fungi on the planet.
Yeah.
Isn't that enough?
So I think there's two reasons. One reason is the simplicity of how proteins are built, at least in terms of sequence. And of course, there comes structure prediction and whatnot. But in principle, statistically speaking, all the information is in the sequence and may glossing over a few complexities. All the information is in the sequence. So it's a simple space to design in. When you look at general molecules, those are not sequences. So the complexity multiplies. I think that's one reason. As for your question, don't we have enough proteins? Proteins in nature have not evolved to do the things we want them to do. One very simple example of this is pharma production, a field that Provolut has worked in as a consulting company partnering with Big Pharma. So Big Pharma wants to produce their compounds, their therapeutic compounds, and nature typically catalyzes reactions. So proteins that catalyze reactions, enzymes, they catalyze reactions from one tiny molecule to another tiny molecule. And quoting a scientist from Sanofi, in pharma production, it's bulky substrate, bulky substrate, bulky substrate, and that never happens in nature. So you are dealing with big, big molecules that you're trying to assemble, basically, through biocatalysis. And it's just not something that nature ever wanted to do. It's not interested in that.
So you would say you can go beyond what nature has given us because the tasks that we as humans want to do with proteins are not captured by nature.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah.
Beyond pharma production, where would you... I mean, there is a lot of potential across industries, right? From crop science to, I don't know, carbon fixation in battling climate change, in biomaterials, in any area. So I tried to figure out a little bit how big this space is. It's a little bit fractionated, but there is massive economic potential in designing better proteins, right?
Yeah. Yes. In principle, there's massive potential. In reality, the incentives push protein design towards certain areas, and that would be pharma, very clearly. And in pharma, mostly designing new therapeutics, where protein design is a small part in the beginning, really, pharma production. And then other high-priced products like baby formula, because people are willing to pay a lot for that. Cosmetics, because people are willing to pay a lot.
Collagen.
Collagen, for example.
Which does by a big meta-analysis, not improve your skin, just as a disclaimer.
But and you shouldn't eat it because it's a bad source of protein.
Yeah.
But the reality of incentives is that, for example, carbon fixation is extremely difficult to do from an economic perspective without a CO2 tax, and a big one, because biological technologies are very expensive to develop and to deploy, so it rarely makes economic sense. I mean, that's one of the things that you have to give to the EU administration. It sees something like this and then does it. The problem is we don't have the economic firepower to make it matter in the world right now. Mm-hmm. And that's why it doesn't matter that there's a CO2 price in Europe if nobody else follows.
Right. But would you say, I mean, lowering the threshold of protein production, so making it cheaper, more accessible, will also make it more accessible to other areas? So I think probably the principles that you would apply to pharma production are applicable across the board, right? I mean, it's just improving the properties of protein.
Yeah, and you see that happening. Like agriculture, for example, is doing the stuff that pharma has done 15 years ago because now it's cheap. Same for chemistry, because chemical companies are operating very low margins. BASF, for example, where my dad worked, operating very low margins. They can't afford any fancy stuff. So they're using what pharma used like a decade or two ago.
In general, for those who are not in the field, in the scientific field, would describe the path from the wet lab to in silico, in general, kind of. What is the initial game changer for you, for your company, for the industry in itself?
Or to replace parts of wet lab with in silico?
In part, people have just realized that this is possible and they start to believe it. Overall, I've been in machine learning before, it's been a hype. And overall, I was... Like, when it became a hype, I was looking at what people said, oh, you can do this with AI and machine learning. And I was like, yeah, you were able to do this 5 years ago in exactly the same quality. Mm-hmm. You just now realized mm-hmm. that you can do it, in fact. So that's one part. It's just perception. The other part is a combination of the parts where you have a lot of data. Namely, you have a lot of sequences. You don't know what they're doing, but you have a big databases of protein sequences. Mm-hmm. And people just train to predict one part of the sequence given other parts of the sequence, which is kind of a brain dead task. It's the brain dead task that also chatbots are fulfilling. But as we have come to realize, this brain dead task, if you give it enough data, you will draw some knowledge out of it. And now this knowledge that you can use to represent a sequence, and if you then combine this, for example, with wet lab data, it's easier to have even a small data set like 20 different protein sequences rather than 1,000. You get 20 different protein sequences and you can predict what would happen if you would put a 21st or a 22nd in the wet lab without having to do it, which gives you the power of then prioritizing. So you have 20 that you actually measured, you predict the property that you did measure, you predict this property for 20 million, and you filter down to the most promising, I don't know, 96, that you then bring to the wet lab.
So in the end, it's sheer numbers, a multitude, zillions of ones and zeros.
You are trying to replace the expensive wet lab work yeah. with much cheaper computation.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
I feel like the payoff would be dual. I mean, on the one hand, just, I mean, really saving time and money, which is huge in pharma. I mean, you just...
Especially time.
Often. Yeah. But on the other hand, would you say with the help of AI, you are able to design proteins that you would have not been able to reach via directed evolution, via wet lab technologies?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You would never even dare. I mean, you see it in older papers. People are extremely cautious in what they do because it's so easy to fuck up a protein.
It's okay. We can put the E. We're allowed to swear.
So it's really easy to ruin a protein. So if you don't have guardrails, you're trying to be conservative. Mm. And that's also what we have seen with people that we worked with. They were super conservative as to what they recommended us to do. Mm. Sometimes we've been fresh and we said, but why not introduce many more mutations? And we failed, actually. So it's tricky to learn how to best explore the design space. What I like to say is, okay, you have a great predictor of your properties, but if you look in the wrong part of space, then you just predict what's the best out of bad sequence. And that doesn't help you much.
Do you think it also influences the training data? I mean, that in the past, the researchers have been quite conservative, so probably more exciting or more deviant sequences would also not be covered, right? So
in part, but I think what's been worse is that people did not report negative data.
Yeah, of course.
So they only reported sequences that worked for the purpose that they were interested in and not the ones that didn't work. And that when we started out, we told everybody, please keep bad sequences because it helps machine learning to weed them out. It would help you, by the way, as well, if you kept this data around, you just didn't think of it.
Yeah, there's, of course, yeah. I mean, this is something that we discuss quite often. There is a bias towards reporting positive data. Yeah. I mean, this is very clear. I mean, you mentioned, right, that there is a hype in the field. Where would you say, I mean, when we look at the landscape of what people are doing, like large language models for designing new proteins like Profluent, for example, is doing, or having more like the Rosetta Alpha fold-based approaches, or also what you guys are doing, of course. But do you feel like there is a certain model that will prevail, or do you think we're just in a fluent space where models will develop further and where we have to just keep an open mind in which direction we're moving?
So I used to tell everybody we're not interested in structure. Structure is completely captured by sequence, which is statistically speaking true. I had a guest on my podcast on machines and molecules, Martin Steinegger, who is very well known for his bioinformatics toolkits, MM62 and so on. And he said, yeah, I thought sequence captures everything, but structure is really useful, I found out. And I think it will not be a certain approach that will prevail, but people that want to solve problems and they don't care so much how they solve them, as long as they solve them, those will prevail. It's not about being religious about, okay, I'm only doing this or that.
And is there one thing where you say this is clearly overhyped in the range of what you want to share?
I wouldn't say a method that is overhyped.
Okay.
I think something that was overhyped is, again, overhyped is a certain type of business model where companies would say, okay, our business model is not we develop a therapeutic or we develop some final product, but we are a pure digital service provider. This has been a recurring theme over the past few decades that people came again and again and thought, oh, we'll just do the digital part. We won't develop actual products. Sometimes companies came out that are profitable and doing okay, but it's overall, it's not been a recipe for success. And also this time around, it seems like this.
Can we talk about your company a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Where you come from, where the starting point was, and this expertise in data and biology, biotech, and proteins. Where did that come from? How many people are you? What are your current projects? To learn a little bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. So we are six right now. The co-founders have backgrounds in machine learning, that's me, then business and biochemistry, that's Philip and Jelena. Mm-hmm. Jelena was a cancer researcher for her academic career. And
so she's an MD?
No, she has a PhD in biochemistry.
Oh, okay, got it. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, basically she had to put up with me saying, let's do a purely digital company until, we've hit several walls. We've tried to go through them. And in part we did. We're working with big pharma companies now, AstraZeneca, for example, which we hear is quite the achievement because it's super difficult, and that I can attest to get to work with big pharma at all.
Right.
But yeah, in the end, we learned probably we should do therapeutic development.
Yeah.
That's what we do now.
Okay.
So yeah, you're investing in your own pipeline now?
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
We're working on our
very
own
cool
pipeline.
Which field?
Cancer, colorectal and breast right now.
Okay.
So epithelial cancers. And we are working on a new mode of action. So basically, we're trying to make the application of mustard gas to patients more specific to the tumor. I recently read that it seems that our chemotherapies are all descendants of mustard gas.
Yeah,
is this because of the guardrails, because of the protective way Big Pharma acts? I mean, we had Big Pharma on this podcast as well in the past, and of course we in our daily work have an impression of the actions and the mode of Big Pharma a little bit, a glimpse at least of it. So was this a decision, like intrinsic, that you made to feed your own pipeline? Or is it more out of a sense of frustration when it comes to dealing with Big Pharma?
Frustration in the sense of learning, yes. That plays a role, but I would rather say we were just excited about the approach that we were approached with. So we were excited about this new modality. And we thought this really could work. We thought it could be very, it would be very flexible if things go wrong. And things, if there's one thing in the therapeutic development, that's for sure, is things go wrong. So yeah, that was a large part of it. And this frustration in the sense of learning part is you realize, among other things, that you will never have an outsized impact by being a pure service provider.
Right. Thank you for the openness.
Makes sense. Do you feel that your background in linguistics, but also your interest in psychology, helps you navigate these kind of interactions? And also, because, I mean, you have now, I mean, you have founded the company, but you have also gone through different business models, probably many, many client discussions. Is there anything that you maybe can also share with our listeners who work in biotech that could be a good hint, a good tip, something maybe for yourself, how to deal with something that doesn't go so well, but also how to bring people together who I think speak very different languages, right, in this space?
Has it helped me? Yes, on the very personal level. I think I'm the one who's always obsessing over wording all the time. Leading a team, I think the interest in psychology is super important, and the interest in building and how to build good and nurturing relationships as something that I had to learn over the course of this company is to be, how should I put it? At sometimes something that feels hard on a personal level is what you have to do because of reality of economics and of cash flow, basically. I think coming to your question about how to bring people together, I'm not sure my input is super important there as to, I don't know, moderating how people talk, rather getting the right people together that want to solve problems first and foremost, that try to see the bigger picture and adapt to it and always take a step back to see the big picture, take a step closer to see the details and solve them. Yeah, that's a very typical balance that has to be struck, I think.
Do you feel like there is any, when you're dealing with people, that there is any misconceptions people have about AI-based protein design? So like something that people feel like, yeah, but this should be possible. I've read it on the news and then it's not possible. Or also the other way around, that they feel maybe they're too conservative in their thinking and actually a lot more is possible.
I think people don't realize what these systems look like and how they work. So basically, when you tell them about limits of an approach, they say, yeah, I understand. It's fine if the results don't look great. But then when you come with the results and they don't look great, it's like, why didn't this work? Mm-hmm. I think what comes in there is really the different viewpoints or the fact that biochemists, molecular biologists, they never do this kind of data science work. What counts there, and that's why they're so conservative, is getting something that works. And there's 100 million things that can go wrong. And you never know which problem it was that ruined your results. When you're a service provider, especially, it's very easy to be blamed as the service provider. Sometimes it's a bit difficult then to get the next gig, of course. But I think there's a big difference inside the company where we learn to speak each other's language and how you communicate with the outside. Pharma has been very disappointed. AI people promise so much. Now they don't deliver. Yeah. It's like, if AI people hadn't promised so much, you would never have worked with them. Yeah. That's the problem.
True. Absolutely.
Yeah, but I also see this frustration, I mean, even in a small sense, that, I mean, many of the biotech or pharma clients that we come in contact with, they have very high expectations of how AI can solve things that AI has nothing to do with. It's more like digitization of their company that would also be would be a very nice to have thing, but that I cannot solve with an AI model. Yeah. That's more like a culture shift that needs to be implemented.
Talking AI real quickly, I would be interested in your take. A friend of mine who's a philosophy professor, data professor, AI, said a few years back in a conversation we had, maybe the next stage AI will be not to rely on data dumps, but to make it more autonomous, solve problems with smaller data sets and get more innovative, if you will.
Making
needing less data, making more sense?
I mean, yeah, that was is our specialty when we work in pharma production. Like the really worst thing that we had was 13 data points of 13 different proteins that a pharma client came to us with, and we had to make sense of it, and big limitations to how much sense you can make from this. But after quite some work, there is information you can draw out of this.
You're talking about you developed the algorithm in a fashion that it was able to draw more sense of the small data set?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Can you share anything about your model, or is that completely
secret,
behind the curtain?
I mean,
CIA.
It depends on what you mean with the model. There's a lot of things that we have worked on in the meantime. So I can say something about the initial thing that we worked on. So the initial model that we worked on was prediction of measurement values for new proteins, be it stability, binding, catalytic rate for enzymes.
So functional assay outcomes.
Assay data, yes. In the very beginning, I massaged an algorithm that I had for time series prediction, which seems very different from the data science perspective. It's not very different. So one of the most important things was to get a prediction algorithm that also allows you to design of experiments. So you don't want to measure, if you have one sequence and a very similar sequence and they both are supposed to be very good, then do you put both of them in the lab? Maybe not, because they are so similar and you don't learn so much from the second one, so you leave it out. That was one of the main things, to be able to do design of experiments. In the meantime, we've worked on very specialized things that use other modules, like for structure prediction, for stability prediction, expressibility, all of them in the mix, in order to be able to predict, if I split a protein, will I be able to reassemble it later at the tumor site so that it activates a mechanism, basically, of killing the tumor. And this is super specialized to our particular approach.
How important do you feel are collaborations in your space, like some way of sharing data or bringing together different models or learning from one another?
Okay, collaboration in that sense is extremely rare. Pharma companies don't tend to share data unless they want you to do something with it. They don't share it with each other typically. Would it be important? I'm not 100% sure right now at the current state, because data that is in pharma companies is in not a good shape, typically. They don't even make sense of it themselves, oftentimes. There is a lot of data curation that would need to be done. Like, even going to clinical trials, you are encoding the gender of the patient in incompatible ways. I think once we get to a very general mechanism, like language models are, of making sense of rather unstructured data, then it makes sense to share data.
And if you say, like, the data in pharma companies is not in a good shape, how do you feel about, like, there are some companies, right, who have taken it upon themselves to really produce data now, like Recursion or Zyra or some others, who say, like, it's part of the business model to build this huge data sets to train our models? Would you say this is something that makes sense, or is it more of a...
If you have the right thing that you are measuring, then yes. And the right thing might not be what you think. I don't know. There's a lot of companies springing up around designing binders for certain receptors. But I think that's because it's kind of a low-hanging fruit. It's not so difficult to predict this anymore. I think there's probably more difficult things to predict, but that are also more valuable. One thing for biologics would be probably immunogenicity. There's much more complex properties that are harder to measure, but that would be very valuable to be able to predict also.
Mm. Yeah. 10 years from now, what's going to be in the pipeline for you, for your company? What will you be working on then?
The next therapeutics, I guess.
Will you stick to cancer, do you think? Or do you think there's other exciting diseases in that sense?
I think we will stick to everything that can make a difference.
Good answer.
That's really the driver. There's a lot of diseases that ruin people's lives. I think from the idea of it, regenerative medicine is also very interesting. Only it didn't bring many results, but it's interesting to think about how to keep the body in a good shape so that it doesn't develop illnesses.
Yeah, interesting. We've been talking about that many times in this podcast. And I mean, it's also fancy stuff, not only in the Silicon Valley, but also worldwide, I think.
All of what we're talking about are lab-produced proteins, basically, right? Are there any approaches to put AI-designed proteins into organisms or into human gene therapies?
In human gene therapies, yes. We've worked on one.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah, Avant-Garde is an Italian-English startup. Mm-hmm. They are working on gene therapy for diseases of the eye. Mm-hmm. We have been working with them in the past. And yeah, definitely for gene therapy, it's one of the big promises. Yeah, and other than that, I mean, people like Toby Abb are working on putting engineered proteins in plants. He's working on a very low level. So he's very interested in the biological mechanisms. He has been when we worked with him. I'm not sure how far he's gone into like getting this into production, quote unquote. One of the big problems being that plants grow so slowly.
And how far, I think maybe as a final question, do you think, I mean, this is a little bit philosophical, but how far do you think we'll deviate in our proteomes in the nearer future? So if, I mean... We as a planet of different species, do you think we will start to accelerate evolution a lot through AI-driven protein design? Or do you think this is more like a small gimmick and will not have any influence on our evolution at all?
If you ask Chris Ball, a friend of mine, AI proteins. He says, yeah, in 20, 40 years, we'll be all different. Like we as humans will have changed ourselves. Let me think about it, because it's not a question I actually ask myself so much. Probably, I guess. Yeah, I think certain things are a no-brainer to change genetically also. Like, I don't know, something super simple is like if fetus has a genetic coding problem where they can't make a certain enzyme, and you could do gene therapy to the fetus so that the baby, when it comes out, actually produces the enzyme rather than needing enzyme replacement therapy. I think that's a no-brainer, big win. And there's other things that are genetic diseases, like, I don't know, breast cancer. There's certain forms of breast cancer that are genetically predisposed, and you could just change it in when you have a daughter. It
doesn't change mankind, though, I think.
That doesn't change much, no.
In that sense, it's been a diplomatic answer, I think, because, of course, there is deeper stuff that is thinkable, not only if you're a George Orwell fan, I think.
I mean, honestly, I don't think we would lose much if everybody was as smart as they can be and as healthy as they can be. I think that's a good idea.
With chip implant or without? Yeah,
I am a believer that we'll soon have neuroimplants to sync.
To my friend Peter Schlech.
Thank you very much, Inma.
Can I ask one extra question for the people who are actually viewing our podcast? What is on your sweater?
Oh, yes. Fair question.
It's a analyzed protein. And then maybe this is up for interpretation.
Okay.
So there's an alpha helix, a loop, and
some globular sequences and and a nematode.
Yeah, maybe. Exactly.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
For being our guest today in the BioRevolution podcast. Please leave a comment on Spotify if you want to and request topics we might talk about here at the BioRevolution podcast. And we have further info at
science-tales.com.